The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
And we'll say, so there's a difference between that and the fullness of truth as it's found in Christ. There's that difference. But then there's a further difference, in that you take the meaning as you see that fulfillment in Christ and apply its significance to your people. So there's a, you're not just giving an essay, you're giving a sermon. So this line is my way of saying that I do agree with Adams. And of course, it means you don't leave anything out, because whatever's revealed here is what you find here. But you get the connections right. That's right. So I have, so that means that, you know, I don't have any objection to Jay's point that it's often good to form your outline in terms of significance. And what he's thinking about, remember, is not just some little insignificant. I didn't mean to get boxed up by that word, but some little insignificant detail. No, no. You want to deal with. Jay says that, you know, you want to deal with the main thrust of the passage. Why is it in the Bible? Why do people, and see, I'm willing to say even more. Not only why was it in the Bible when the Bible was written, but what ought we to learn from it now, where we are in our context? And that's where Poitras helps a lot with his describing of that whole structure of discourse analysis. Yes. Yeah, well, Luther did give him an F. That's right. But you've got James 2. See, my brethren, hold not the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with respect to persons. So James obviously is assuming a lot and taking it from there. So he's certainly writing as a Christian, but he's writing with strong emphasis on the moral consequences. If you want to see how I would try to handle some things in James, I wrote a series of devotional meditations in Table Talk, R.C. Sproul's magazine. And the last ones, I think the last three issues, I have meditations on James in it. And I think it's, I know James is hard to preach. I realize that. I realize that's why Luther said what he said and all. He didn't see it there. But I think it's, we're just not taking seriously enough the context in which James wrote and the assumptions that are involved in that context. And that James would speak as he does of Jesus Christ shows him to be a believer, and he's assuming the basic structure of the gospel. So I don't think you're bringing it in. You're just pointing to the underpinnings on which what he writes stands. You've got to take a short break. Let's keep it real short because our time's running out for today. This is 22. What do you think about it?
All right.
32, you said. 32, yes. Yeah. Excuse me. Oh, that's very helpful. It brings to mind another matter that ties in closely with that that I'd like to mention to you. Ballantyne, a fellow named Ballantyne, has written a book on prayer in Israel. It's a recent book, and fascinating. He tells us that he was a young man at the time of Vietnam, and he had his problems about going into action at Vietnam and the draft and whether he should be a draft dodger or whatever. And he talked to his minister about it. He was in a Southern Baptist church. And his minister told him that your duty as a Christian is not to understand. Sometimes you can't understand. But your duty is to obey, to do what God tells you to do. And he felt that was a thoroughly unsatisfactory word from his minister. And so he got to thinking about it. And then he decided that in the Old Testament, there were people who argued with God. And he got quite interested in this whole matter of arguing with God. And he did his doctoral dissertation on that, arguing with God. And the book is a very disturbing book. He goes through the Old Testament to deal with everyone who argued with God. And he investigates their arguments. And he pushes many of them to the point of blasphemy. I was looking for a note I had here. I didn't come up with it. But one of the passages in Jeremiah, I forget what chapter now, but one of the passages in Jeremiah where Jeremiah is arguing with God, and then in the beginning of the next chapter, God rebukes Jeremiah for his argument. what Ballantyne claims is that in the Old Testament, people argue with God, say exactly what an atheist would say, but they say it to God's face. And they are accusing God. Well, in the Jeremiah passage that I've forgotten the reference to, Jeremiah says that God is a deceitful brook, that he's waters of deceit. That as you, I guess the idea is you go to an Araba expecting there to be some water and there isn't any. God promises water but doesn't give it. So Jeremiah accuses God of deceit. And Ballantyne pushes that to the point of blasphemy and says that people struggle with God saying blasphemous things. And he says this is always risky. It might mean that you'd be through with God forever, but you got to take that kind of risk to be honest. And God wants honesty above everything else. And even if you say what the atheist says, if you say it to God's face, that's different from saying it to somebody else about him. So it's a very, very disturbing book because you have to look at the exegesis of the passages quite carefully because he's done his Hebrew homework well, so he's got arguments for making these passages as extreme as he can possibly make them. And then he says that this is how we are to relate to God. And so don't let anybody tell you faith is submission. Faith is not submission. Faith is dialogue. So you get in and tell God what you think of him, and God will come back to you. And didn't quite say how God might come back to you. But anyway, he talks about these dialogues with God. And when I was teaching a course on prayer, and I got quite interested in that book of Ballantyne's. But then I got to thinking, where in the New Testament do you have prayers like the accusations of Job, or like some of the things even Moses says, or certainly like the things that Jeremiah says? Where in the New Testament do you find those statements that seem to be accusatory toward God? And I thought about prayer, you know, like Paul's prayers in the epistles, they're not like that. I thought of Jesus' prayer in the Gospels, that's not like that. Ballantyne got all upset because he was told that the prayer of faith meant submitting to the will of God, that the prayer says, thy will be done. And he wanted to give us room to say, your will is terrible and I don't want it done. So this made me think. Well, where in the New Testament do you get one of these prayers asking if God is really being just in a way, or raising the question as to God's what God's doing on the cross? Romans 9, in a way, is a question of how God can reject Israel. That's right. But, of course, it isn't a scream of protest. It's an explanation, so we'll understand. No, on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? God's promised not to forsake his own. Jesus is the only one who's been perfectly faithful. In a sense, he's the only one that can claim the promise. And so he says, why have you forsaken me? Right? On the cross. And then sort of a light dawned, because that passage has always meant a lot to me. Why have you forsaken me? And in a way I couldn't explain, I find in Jesus' question an answer to all my questions. I don't know if you understand what I mean when I say that, but the fact that he said it, whose ultimate prayer is, your will be done, and whose ultimate prayer is, into your hands I commend my spirit. The fact, of course, he was searched. He was abandoned. He was forsaken. He paid a price that we can never possibly understand. And he did it for us. And because he's done it for us, because he's asked that why, it changes it for us, doesn't it? We never have to ask that why. Because we know that all things work together for good to them that love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. And you do not find that accusatory language directed against God in the New Testament than you have in the Old Testament. And it seems to me there's a simple reason for that. It's Christ's cry on the cross. And his cry on the cross then, and his work for us, transforms all our suffering, doesn't it? Transforms it all. Because instead of suffering, the suffering of the righteous being an inexplicable mystery, the suffering of the righteous becomes communion with Christ in his suffering. He suffered for us, and in doing that, he changed the very form of suffering. He made it a privilege to suffer with him. So there's a tremendous change there. We'll get into some of this again, because when we look tomorrow at the Psalms and Friday, Lord willing, at the wisdom literature, we'll see how these things are put together. But I mention it because it's so apropos of your statement there about Jacob's wrestling with God. But in Jacob's wrestling with God, here's a good question to ask. It was a wrestling match. Wrestling matches were very important in the ancient Near East, you know, even in Sumerian mythology, you've got big wrestling matches, Gilgamesh wrestles and all. So you get all these wrestlings and symbolic sort of wrestlings too, wrestlings that have important significance, ordeal wrestlings. Questions would be determined by ordeal, and the ordeal would be a wrestling match. So here is an ordeal for Jacob, so you can situate this in the time and culture and get a lot of help just that way. But as you look at this wrestling match of Jacob, who won? Yeah, that, of course, that statement isn't in Genesis. That's where is that? Hosea, isn't it? That it says he's... maybe I'm confused. Let me look here. There's a further statement where it talks about who won. You're right. Sure, you're right. 28. Your name shall be no more Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven, you have fought with God and with men, and have prevailed. Sure, you're right. There it is right there. But you see, what we're told in that passage, that he fought with God and prevailed, is what we're... It's also reflected on... where is that? In Isn't it in Amos where it says he fought with God? Let me see if I have a note that would say here. Hosea. I said Hosea first, then I said Amos. Hosea 12, good. Let's look at that. Verse 2, Hosea 12, 2. The Lord also has a controversy with Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways. According to his doings will he recompense him. In the womb he took his brother by the heel, and in his manhood, or in his strength, he had power with God. Yes, he had power over the angel and prevailed. He wept and made supplication to him. He found him at Bethel, and there he spoke with us, even Yahweh, the God of hosts. So in that interesting passage in Hosea, we're told that Jacob had power with God and prevailed, which of course reflects the statement in Genesis that he had, that Jacob won. So Jacob won. Would you have to modify how he won or whether he won? Well, what's the balancing consideration? He won, but what? Yeah. And even about whether he won. Yeah? Yeah. Well, he was lame. At the end of the bout, he was lame. He had to go away, and they don't eat of that part of the thigh because they all remember how Jacob got lame. Now, you know, a lame wrestler, and he's lame before the bout's over. So if he won, it was sure a funny way to win. Because nobody came to hit his leg with an iron bar. The angel just touched him, and his right leg was gone, and he couldn't push off with it. So, whatever. So he's lame. Yeah, he's lame. So he won, but he lost. And yet he somehow won by losing, didn't he? It's very strange. Now, how about the angel? Did the angel win? Well, in a sense, the angel lost, right? Because Jacob was determined to have the blessing, and Jacob got the blessing. But did the angel win in a sense? Yes, you've already told me the angel won, because obviously it was God's purpose that Jacob would receive the blessing. And so the angel also won by losing. By yielding to Jacob's prayer, the angel accomplished what the angel was there to accomplish. And it's called Peniel, because that means face of God, you know. And Jacob began to see something of the face of God in the morning, and that's why he called it Peniel. Some of the critics have said that the angel that wrestled with Jacob was a night spirit, and that with the coming of the sunlight, the night spirit would evaporate or something. And so it was a threat to the angel. And the angel said, I got to get out of here because the sun's coming up. But that's not the point. The point is not the threat to the angel. The point is the threat to Jacob, because he's wrestling in the darkness and he doesn't see the face of the one he's wrestling with. But if the sun comes up, then he'll see the very face of God, which is why he calls it Peniel, the face of God. Because in the morning, in the dimness of the beginning of the sunrise, he saw some of the lineaments of the very face of God. So you've got to feed that into the equation. What other things about that incident are important? Well, there's a lot in the language when you study the passage from the standpoint of the language. There's the fact that the two companies theme. When Jacob comes into the territory of the Holy Land, he's met by two companies of angels. It's in the dual to represent a double company. And then Jacob himself divides those that are with him into two companies, according to the mothers, you know, the Rachel, whom he loved, but also Leah. So you get Leah and her children, Rachel and her children. So they're divided into two companies that way. And of course, the whole thing's about the meeting of two companies, the company with Jacob and the company with Esau, because he hears that Esau's coming with what does not sound exactly like a welcoming committee. He's got a small army with him. And so how is he going to meet Jacob? you don't extend hospitality when you come marching with as many men as Jacob, as Esau has with him. So there's this theme of meeting and encountering. But you see, in a sense, this encounter with the angel becomes the central encounter for all the other encounters. Do you see that? I mean, he met the guardian angels as he came in, and he's got to meet Esau when he gets in. But in between all those encounters of the companies, there's the basic encounter with the angel that represents the very presence of the Lord, which again shows us what I think we so often find in the Old Testament, that this is a theological issue, you see. And again, do you see how it's faith and grace that comes to the fore? Because why is Jacob coming back to the land? Well, because God told him to. And what does Jacob plead as he prays to God as he comes back into the land? You have his prayer there in Genesis. And Jacob says that he's coming back because God commanded him to come back, which is true. And therefore, this encounter is the basic encounter. Jacob fears to disobey God. But he's been a cheater and a deceiver. But now he wants to claim God's promise, and he wants to seek God's blessing. And even along the way, even though he did wrong things, he was seeking for the right thing. He was seeking to receive the blessing of God. So you get the agony of the combat. And you see Jacob's crisis there in his encounter with Esau. But underlying that is encounter with God. That's what's fundamental to his life. And then you see in the combat, the fearful adversary that comes against him in that deadly bout through the night, and also the crippling touch of the angel, and the fact that Jacob comes to know his adversary, who really has all power over him. He can't possibly win in his own strength. He's touched and lamed by the angel. But the agony of the combat leads into the wonder of the victory, which is a triumph of faith, because Jacob must strive, he must persevere, he must hold on, because this is his only hope. And he is therefore trusting in God and in the promise of God. And in his prayer, he claims the blessing as one who is unworthy. It's a very different from the attitude he had shown before. So it's a triumph of faith, but it's also a triumph of grace. The victor, by grace, is Israel, the lame prince. He strives with God, he has power with God and prevails, and he receives God's blessing and sees God's face. He's delivered from the hand of God, not just from the hand of Esau. And he can see Esau's face in 33:10, because he's seen God's face. Cast me not away from your presence, hide not your face from me. So, you see, the important thing is that the blessing is connected with seeing the very face of God. And that, you see how that drives you forward to Christ, necessarily. And so the victor who is Jacob, in a sense, the victor by grace is Jacob. The victor of grace is the Lord at Peniel, and he would lose by winning, and he would win by losing. It's an interesting interplay there. And then not only the Lord at Peniel, but the servant at Peniel. You see, it isn't always easy homiletically to do this, and that's why the point that was made, a very important difference between the actual sermon outline and all the exegesis that supports it, because the difficulty about Christ in the Old Testament is an embarrassment of riches, because Christ is the Lord, and he's obviously in this scene as the theophanic angel. It's it's a theophany. It's Jesus Christ before the incarnation appearing and wrestling with Jacob. So he's there as the Lord wrestling with Jacob. So it's It's Christ who gives Jacob the blessing. In the Old Testament, epiphany of Christ the Lord. But the other side of it is, Christ comes to be the servant, to fulfill the calling of the servant, so that he is the true Israel, as he's called in Isaiah 49. So who is it that has power with God and prevails for us? Well, of course, it's Jesus Christ. So he is himself the victim. He is the suffering servant. He is smitten of God and afflicted. And there's an interesting little tie in there. And that is that Jacob's thigh is where the angel touches him and where he's lame. And the other places in the Old Testament where Jacob's thigh is referred to, there are two other occurrences. And in those other occurrences, the thigh refers to seed, the descent. It's a euphemism for the organ of generation, for the sexual organ, see? And so you don't have to talk about the sexual organ directly, you talk about the thigh. Like Abraham's servant, remember when he went to find a wife for Isaac, he swore with his hand on Abraham's thigh. Well, that means the hand was placed on the thigh, but placed on the thigh with reference to the seed of Abraham, with reference to those who would be descended from him sexually. So the fact that the thigh is used in the other two occurrences with reference to the sexual organ and therefore to the seed or the descendants of Jacob is interesting. Now, that's the kind of thing that you might or might not want to make use of because of the delicacy of describing these things, perhaps, although after the recent trial, all delicacy seems to be gone. But nevertheless, theologically, how much you want to go into that, I'm convinced that there's a real connection there, that the wounding of Jacob is with reference to his seed. That's why the angel touched him there. And it is in the seed of Jacob that the blow will be struck and that Jesus himself bears it. But Jesus, of course, is as the servant, is the victor. He lives as the one who is struck and receives the blow. He's the one who prevails and wins for us the victory. Which gets back to where we started, that the reason you don't have the adversarial relationship in the New Testament in the way you have it in the Old Testament is because of the resolution of that in Jesus Christ, who is the one who is our prince and who represents us and who has prevailed with God in our behalf in the agony of the cross. Well, I hope that you'll see the importance of realizing that the whole Bible is given to us in the context of God's redemption. That's what God's doing, isn't it? He's saving his people. And that redemption comes through Jesus Christ. And these stories that are told to us and are preserved for us. Sure, they have different levels of significance. Sure, there's an assurance here for Jacob that he will receive the blessing. And Paul builds on that. Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated. There's the difference between Jacob and Esau. And it's Jacob who gets the blessing, in spite of all his deceits and everything else. Whereas it's Esau who in a certain sense is wronged, but is wronged because of his own complete insensitivity to any meaning of the promise. I mean, he's willing to sell it off for a bowl of soup, so he couldn't care less. Nevertheless, there's the distinction between Jacob and Esau, and Jacob prevails because he hangs on, because he won't let go, because he must have the blessing, the desperation of true faith, but also the symbolism of grace that's evident here in the purpose of the angel in appearing to Jacob and in confirming the blessing and the promise to him. So what I was trying to do just then, you see, is to suggest a kind of way of dealing with it, the conflict and the outcome, but to pick up some of the material that you would could justifiably use in building these bridges, and yet realize that as you build it as a sermon, that doesn't keep you from drawing inferences from it as to our relation to these things. That is to say, as Jesus Christ persevered for us, held on, would not let go until he had received the blessing for us and did triumph on the cross. Nevertheless, what Jesus did for us is also an example to us, isn't it? That we lay hold on him and we don't let go, not in any adversarial way, that's all been changed by Christ, but nevertheless, with a desperate grasp. The desperation of faith still applies. And so in that sense, there is a proper moral application, that there's a desperateness to the way in which we lay hold of God. Tomorrow we'll... don't forget, for tomorrow, if somehow digging cars out of the snow and things like that, you didn't yet get to look at a passage, look at one. Tomorrow, look at one from the historical prophets. One from the historical prophets.